Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello. We're beginning with Samuel today. Samuel is such an important person in the Old Testament. He really forms a transition between the period of the judges and the period of the monarchy. This period of the judges is known in Old Testament literature as the Amphictyony. It's a period of loose tribal identification. And we're moving from this loose tribal confederacy into an organized central government, the monarchy. Now, Samuel's going to form that transition. He's part judge and part prophet. He's really a fine, fine Old Testament character. We find that the priest at Shiloh, and that's where we're going to be, in the northern kingdom, and the tribe of Ephraim in the holy place of Shiloh. Eli is the chief priest there now, but his sons are, he just did not have a good family as far as him training them in the Lord. An unfortunate same thing is going to happen to Samuel. I hope you'll turn in the back of your Bible if you're listening to us by audio cassette tape. And if you're watching us by video, here we go to the map and I'll show you where Shiloh is. It's in the tribal allocation of Ephraim. The orange pointer there is right. You see the Dead Sea Scroll and the Dead Sea right at the bottom. We'll focus in now on Shiloh, and you can see right where it is, close to the Jordan River there, just north of Jericho and Jerusalem. Okay, thank you very much. That's the area we're going to be dealing with. Shiloh is one of the last holy places before Jerusalem itself is picked by God. There are several of these holy places. There's Gilgal, Bethel, Shiloh, many of these places. And so the tabernacle is now at Shiloh. Now, the tabernacle, of course, is the tent of the wilderness. And that's where Eli is the high priest there. Let's begin then at 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 9. Then Hannah rose after eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now, really, verse 9 kind of breaks in the context. But her husband, Elkanah, was a very righteous man. He had two wives. Every year, they came to the Shiloh tabernacle to offer sacrifices and have a communal meal with God. During this communal meal, Hannah was sitting there with her husband and the other wife and all the other wife's children, and she just couldn't eat. She was so depressed over being barren. Barrenness in the Old Testament was almost a curse of God, almost like leprosy. She was very distressed, and she left this sacrificial meal in the temple area somewhere, went in to pray. That's where we're going to pick up. Now, Eli, the priest, was sitting on the seat by the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. Maybe a seat of judgment to meet the people, or maybe just a seat where he could see what was happening in this open court area. Now, when it says the temple of the Lord, this is the only place here in chapter 1 and chapter 3, verse 3, where this word temple, it's often translated palace, is used for the tent of meeting or the tabernacle. Now, it's used quite often for Solomon's temple. This is the only place it's used for the tabernacle. Many folks have assumed that there was a building that the tabernacle set in now because of this use. But I really think we're still in the tabernacle setting. Notice it says then, verse 10, and she was greatly distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. Now, she was distressed over the fact that she was barren. You see, in the Old Testament, there is a view that you live on in your children. And to have no children, especially no male children, was a real disaster for these people theologically, as well as emotionally, as well as socially. It was really a disruptive thing. Now, she said, she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, now this vow is a promise. God never says we have to make a vow. But he said if we make a vow, we best keep it. So she is making a vow here, and her husband is going to have to confirm this vow. From the Pentateuch, we know that a wife cannot make a vow without the affirmation of her husband. So she's going to share with him, apparently, and he'll become involved. O Lord of hosts, that's Yahweh. The idea here is God, the captain of the army of heaven, or the leader of the angelic council. That's the idea. If thou will indeed look on the affliction of thy maidservant. Now, the affliction she's talking about is barrenness. And remember me. And do not forget thy maidservant, but will give thy maidservant a son. Now, I'm using the New American Translation of the Old Testament. Son is not a real good translation. The word here is the seed of men, i.e., offspring. It can refer to a girl or a boy, but the context tells us it's a boy. And so, but it's unfortunate to translate it son. It should be offspring. Then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come upon his head. Now what she's saying is, I'm going to dedicate my son to you as a Nazirite. Now, a Nazirite comes from the word Nazar, to vow. And it is in number 6 that the entire description of what are the conditions, what are the period of time. It's very unusual for a Nazirite vow to be a lifelong vow. Now, Samson was a lifelong vow. It seems like John the Baptist in the New Testament and Samuel, but usually it's for a period of time. In the book of Acts, we have Paul taking a Nazirite vow for a limited period. Now, there were several conditions. You might want to look at number 6. One of them is not to drink the fruit of the vine, not even unfermented grape juice, not to eat anything unclean, not to ever have your hair cut. Those were some of the regulations. Now, when it mentions here, now it came about as she continued praying before the Lord that Eli was watching her mouth. What she was doing, she was praying in her heart, but her lips were moving. And Eli thought she was drunk. And he got upset with her and asked her to leave. Look at verse 13. So Eli thought that she was drunk. And what this tells us is there must have been some excess in many of these sacrificial meals. Sacrificial meals held in the temple area were common because the part of the sacrifice given back to the offerer had to be eaten that day and had to be eaten in a holy place. And so usually they came right there to have this sacrificial meal. But apparently there was some excess. Now, we have this in the New Testament, the Lord's Supper or the Agape Feast. When it was first instituted, they had a real problem with drunkenness at Corinth over this. And apparently it's happened here. Now, verse 14. Then Eli said to her, how long will you make yourself drunk and put your wine from you? But Hannah said, no, my Lord, I am a woman oppressed in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink. Now, wine is often linked in the Bible with strong drink. Now, they both have wine as a base, but strong drink is adding certain spices to wine to make it more intoxicating, and that's what it's talking about here. But I have poured my soul out before the Lord. So do not consider your maidservant as a worthless woman. Now, the root of the word worthless woman is the term Belial, and we get that in the New Testament. If you have a concordance, you can see where Paul says, talking about the Lord's Supper, how can this Belial is a later development of the name Satan. But originally in Hebrew, it simply meant worthless, useless. And that's what it's referring to here, a worthless woman. So Eli was a man of God, even though he was a poor administrator of his own house. He says, I'm sorry. Go in peace and may God grant your request. He's apologizing for misrepresenting this lady and thinking wrong thoughts about her. So, we pick up then, let's see, verse 18. And she said, let your maidservant find favor in your sight. So the woman went away, ate, and her face was no longer sad. Now, you know what I like about this? Hannah, she didn't get a request. God didn't instantaneously make her pregnant. But she had gone before the Lord. She had expressed her doubts. She had bore her soul to the Lord, and now she really felt like it was in God's hands. Well, that's a great attitude of prayer. We need to talk with the Lord to anything that concerns us. We need to share with Him. But after we've shared it with Him, we need to leave it in faith with Him. She went on her way, never knowing if God would answer or not, but she believed God would do the best for her in her supplications. What a great attitude this lady had. So she went back to the meal, and she began to eat. And her face, her countenance changed. She got it off of her heart and put it on God's heart. Friend, that's pretty good theology, I think. Now, in verse 19, and they arose early in the morning and worshipped before the Lord and returned again to the house in Ramah. Now, premise is Ramah in the hill country of Ephraim. And Elkanah had relations with Hannah, his wife. Now, had relations is the Hebrew word knew. That's so important. The Hebrew word new is used to describe the most intimate relationship between a man and a woman. But you know, the word new is also used to describe the relationship between God and His people. You see what happened? The Old Testament writers, knowing that God is a personal God, an ethical God, a God of relationships and family, has taken those deepest human interpersonal relationships and has use those analogously for the relationship between God and His people. That's why God is called a husband. That's why God is called a parent. That's why God is called the Goel, or the kinsman redeemer. And that's the idea here. Okay? And the Lord remembered her. Now, this is the idea that God is involved in the conception of children. I don't know if it breaks your heart with the intensity that it does mine, but I want to tell you, abortions in our day need to be thought through by God's people. Here's the implication: that God was involved in this woman's barrenness, and God was involved in this woman's fruitfulness. Now, if that is accurate, then God is involved in the conception of our children. Think about it. Now, we come now to verse 20. And it came about in due time, after Hannah had conceived, that she gave birth to a son, and she named him Samuel. Now, it seems to be that the name Samuel means, because I have asked him of the Lord. But that really fits the name Saul better than it fits Samuel. Samuel is a little bit difficult and ambiguous as far as etymology. It seems to mean his name is El. Now, not meaning that God's name is El, but that Samuel calls upon God. And so God is the source of his strength. And that seems to be the idea of the name Samuel. Okay. The word ask is going to have be a real play on the words later on this lesson in verse 27 and 28. And I'm going to hold off on the word study on that till we get to chapter 1, 27 and 28. Now, in verse 21 it says, the man Elkanah went up with all his household to offer the Lord the yearly sacrifice and pay his vow. Now, apparently his vow was connected with Hannah's vow, because in the Old Testament, a woman could not vow without the association of her husband, and that seems to be what we're talking about. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, I will not go up until the child is weaned. Now, Oriental women suckled their baby much longer than we do. 2 years is common, and 3 years is normal, probably because there is a relationship between nursing children and not continue to be pregnant, which is part of the motivation for society, I think. But then secondly, I think there's that real close, this mother was going to give this baby up, and she wanted him with her for these beginning years. And so 2 or 3 years we're talking about when she took the child to the tabernacle. Then I will bring him that he may appear before the Lord and stay there forever. She really was going to fulfill her vow. She had promised the Lord, and she was going to keep her promise. Okay, let's look at the verse 27 and 28 before I move to chapter 2. For this boy I prayed, and the Lord has given me my petition. Now, my petition is the same root in Hebrew as the word which I ask of him. And both of those are the same root as the word in 28, and I also dedicated him. So the word petition, the word ask, and the word dedicated are all the same root word in Hebrew. Now, I think King James has the word lent, but that is not the connotation. This is the ask for son that she's giving back to the Lord, and that's the idea here. Now, let's go to chapter 2, and I want to deal with verses 1 through 11, which is the song of Hannah. And this is a tremendous song. It's much like many of the other great songs of the Old Testament, the song of Miriam, the song of Deborah, the song of Hannah, the song of Anna in the New Testament, the song of Mary. And it's a sung praise to God, a rhythmical, poetic, almost musical praise to God. Let's begin then. It has much similarity to Luke chapter 1, verses 46 through 55, Mary's praise to God. Now, then Hannah prayed and said, my heart exults in the Lord. That's the word Yahweh. Look at the capital R, the covenant name for God. My horn is exalted in the Lord. I didn't know Hannah had a horn. Well, have you ever seen that famous statue of Moses where Moses has two horns? I think it was Michelangelo, but he blew it, whatever that famous sculpture was. A horn in Hebrew does not mean literal horns. It's a metaphor from the animal world speaking of power, strength, might, dignity. And so the word horn in the Old Testament means power, strength, that kind of thing. So her strength is exalted in the Lord. And look at this next little phrase, another real strange one. My New American Standard has, my mouth speaks boldly against my enemies. Look at your Bible, chapter 2 and about 2, 1D. The Hebrew there is stretched wide. So my mouth is stretched wide. And these translators meant to speak boldly. No, I don't think so. This stretch wide means the opening of the mouth as swallowing something. And I think it's the analogy of Sheol, or the realm of the dead, swallowing people. And so it means defeat. My mouth is widened so as to swallow my enemy, defeat him, remove him from the scene. And I think that's a better etymology than speak. Because I rejoice in thy salvation. Now, the word salvation in the Old Testament does not have all the spiritual connotations that you are used to from the New. It's the idea of deliverance, physical blessing. And that's what Hannah's thanking God for, is this child and the blessings of that. Look at verse 2. There is no one holy like the Lord. Indeed, there is no one beside thee, nor is there any rock like our God. What is a strong monotheistic statement very early here in the Judges' time. What she's saying is, there's no one like you. There's no one beside you. You are unique. You are one of a kind. You know, and that's a strong statement. Now, it says there's no one besides thee. That's similar to one of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt have no other God before me. That word in Hebrew means there's no other God in my category, friend. I'm the only one there is. No one behind me, beside me, before me. I am it. That's the idea. Now, when it says here, rock, the word rock is often used for God. Matter of fact, it's used for Jesus a few times, the rock in the wilderness in Paul's Corinthian correspondence. The idea of God being a rock is beautifully seen in Deuteronomy 32, verses 4, 15, and 30, and in Psalm 18:2. Psalm 18:2 has more names for God in those first two verses than any place in the whole Bible. God is called a rock for several reasons. The rock's strength, the rock's dependability, the rock's changelessness, and the idea of a rock being a high, impregnable fortress. And that's the idea when God is called a rock. Then it says, boast no more so very proudly, and do not let arrogance come out of your mouth, for the Lord is the God of knowledge. Now, this is an intensive plural in Hebrew, means that all knowledge belongs to God, and therefore man shouldn't be arrogant about what he knows. The last one says, with him actions are weighed. This is a commercial term. The word honor your parents, the Ten Commandments, is the same kind of word. It means to give due weight to. So it means to be accurate in your balancing, to be fair in your commercial dealings, where the root of this word. So if you look at verse 10, where it says, the Lord will judge the ends of the earth. Now, that's a surprising statement, very universal for a person to speak at this period. But what she's saying is, God is the judge of all the earth. And he's a fair judge. And he's an equitable person. He's a merciful God. And we're going to see those qualities in verses 4, 5, and 7. God will bring a time of setting things straight. God is a judge, a fair judge. Now, then it mentions, the bows of the mighty are shattered, but the feeble grind on strength, gird on strength. Those who were full hire themselves out for bread, and those who were hungry cease to hunger. It's this paradox that is so common in the Bible. Those who are rich and powerful and arrogant will be brought low, and those who are low and poor but trust in God will be lifted up. It's this paradox that the way things are right now, or the way things seem right now, is not the way they're always going to be. In the New Testament, it's a little parable, the first shall be last, and the last shall be first. You got to lose your life to save it. Those are those paradoxes that talk about this kind of thing. Now, it comes to the last little phrase of verse 5, even the barren gives birth to seven. Now, we learned from chapter 2, verse 21, that she gave birth to six anyway. She's a late bloomer, but boy, when she bloomed, she bloomed. Six kids, including Samuel. Now, the word seven here is not a contradiction in the Bible. The word seven is a number of completeness or fullness. So she had the full number of children God wanted her to have. It was six in number, but seven expresses that fullness. Now, then it says, and she who has many children languishes. We learned that the other wife of this fellow was pretty caustic to Hannah. Maybe she's putting a little bit back in there. I don't know. Verse 6. It says, the Lord kills and makes alive. You'll see Deuteronomy 32:20-39, where this idea of God is controller of life. He's the controller of beginning of conception. He's the controller of death. And I think it's very important we see that our lives aren't in our own hands. You know, just because you jog every morning and eat health food, your life's in God's hands. Now, you may have a more robust life as long as you have it. But folks, you can't control your lifespan. Now, and it says, he brings down to Sheol and raises up. Now, Sheol is the word that in the New Testament is translated Hades. So Hades and Sheol are synonymous terms. It is the holding place of the dead, the place the righteous and the unrighteous both go after death. It is a shadowy existence in the Old Testament. So the question is she talking about resurrection here? Well, I'm not saying she couldn't, but I think the context and the theology of the day says that really she's talking about God restoring people to health. God bringing somebody back from a deathbed seems to be more of the idea here. Although I would not rule out the resurrection, because then in verse 10, this is the first use of the term Messiah in the Old Testament. So maybe she knows more than it implies here. I just don't know. Verse 6, 7, and 8 again talk about God raising up the poor, putting down the rich. He's in control of history. He's in control of individual destinies. In verse 9, a very unusual phrase, last part of verse 8 mentions he sets the pillars of the earth, the Lord's, he sets the world on them. Now, this is the ancient view of the world sitting on pillars. Friends, don't try to make the Bible be scientifically accurate. The Bible is not against science. It's pre-science. It is the language of description. This is the ancient way of seeing the earth as sitting on pillars. And you say, oh, it doesn't sit on pillars, so the Bible's wrong. The Bible speaks in the language of description of the day in which it's written. It wasn't meant to be a scientific description. This is saying God is the creator, and that's what we want to affirm. Now, when it mentions here, he keeps the feet of the godly ones, but the wicked ones are silenced in darkness. And this idea of keeping the feet, biblical faith is a lifestyle. So we walk in certain well-worn paths, and those well-worn paths are keeping the feet straight. The wicked will have their feet slip, but the righteous will be placed on a solid footing. That's the idea here. Let me skip down to verse 10, where it says, against them he will thunder in the heavens. That's the word Eli. We learn from Ugaritic that it means the exalted one. Now, notice it mentioned the last part of verse 10, his strength to his king and will exalt the horn of his anointed. Well, there is no king yet. And Samuel really gets mad when they ask for a king. So here we have an unusual reference to the monarchy. Now, some Old Testament critics say, this is a psalm that was written later and put back in Hannah's mouth. There is an element of prophecy here. There has to be. God was meant to be the king. And God's anointed would be the Messiah. And the word anointed is the Hebrew word for Messiah. So I really think what we have here is not an unusual out of chronology reference to the king, but a very precursor, a very foreshadowing reference to the Messiah. You say, well, why do you get that? Well, the use of this psalm so heavily and so similar to the song of praise of Mary in Luke 1, 46 through 55, and the use of the term Messiah here the first time in the Old Testament tells me that there may be more here in this lady's words than we normally give her credit for. God can reveal to those who are sensitive to him great truths. So whether it's this psalm is dealing with resurrection and dealing with Messiah, I don't know. I think it's very dim, but I think it is a brief glimmer of a foreshadowing of the major truth that's going to come in 2 Samuel 7 using David as the type of the Davidic king or Messiah. Well, I think this is a tremendous chapter. I hope you'll read chapters 1 and 2 completely in context before you try to teach this lesson and see how this all fits together. Samuel is going to be a tremendous man of God, but he's going to make the same miserable failure as a parent as Eli did. There's a real word here about religious men need to spend time with their children lest they help so many others for God and lose their own. And boy, Eli and Samuel are the Old Testament witnesses to that truth. It's also very important, I think, that when we come to a conclusion of like this, this poetry has great theology in it. And I hope you'll list the characteristics of God found in this wonderful poem and song by Hannah. I hope that the thing that strikes me in this thing so wonderfully is this lady's faith in her prayer life. Boy, she gave it to God, and she believed he was going to handle it, and she went back to the dinner and ate and her whole attitude changed because she had given this thing to God in prayer and knew that he was going to respond. I've really enjoyed being with you. I hope the outline is helpful to you. And I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.